VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again.
Plus, the Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits by Unknown Tome. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
This is Luke Johnson, the writer who's worked with Wizards of the Coast, White Wolf, Goodman Games, and you're listening to The Tome! Woo!
Welcome to The Tome, episode 170. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley. In this episode, we'll be truly epic as we talk to Mike Shea about running Epic Tier Games. First, let's introduce our guest. He's someone who may have been on the show before. Wait for it.
Yay.
It's the all-powerful Mike Shea!
And the crowd goes wild.
Exactly.
Well, Mike, you have recently released a book about running Epic Tier Games that's full of all kinds of fantastic advice, and my personal campaign has just recently gotten to Epic Tier, so I thought it would be a great time to have you on to get some advice from you about how to run my game better.
Sounds good. I'm excited.
But first, some D&D news.
The first item of news is that the new Monster Builder web app is out. How do you guys feel about it?
I'm fine with it. It's fine.
I'm super ultra not thrilled.
Right. So we should probably tell people who maybe haven't seen it or haven't read about it that it's lacking a lot of the features that the downloadable app had. It's more of a monster re-leveler is like I think what some of the people on Twitter were saying about it. But it is online. It works on Mac and PC, and I think eventually we'll have support with the virtual table.
Is that what this is all about, really? Is it about getting this out and making sure it's stable so that you can incorporate it into the virtual table? Because this is not a monster builder. This is an app that gives you access to fast and dirty leveling of monsters. You can't actually build a monster on it.
Right. And my guess would be that they did want it to get in with the virtual table. And, you know, I think one of the most common things people have to do with monsters is change the level to make it appropriate to what they want out of the encounter.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's primarily what I do.
I
think it's fine. I mean, you know, I didn't pay any extra money for it and it didn't spend a lot of time on it and I didn't have to install any special software, so it didn't really hurt me. You know, some people are making it sound like they, you know, went into their house and stole all their silverware, and that's not exactly true. So I think there's more coming with it, and in the meantime, I'm glad that it's out on the Mac.
Right. Here's where it does hurt me, because I don't do just a lot of simple leveling. I do a lot more monster customization when I use the Monster Builder, and they're not – yes, the downloadable version is still there, but they're not adding anything new to it. So as new – monsters come out, they're not going to be available in that catalog of things for me to pull from or reskin or whatever in the downloadable version.
Yeah.
So the web app version is not hurting me in its existence, but the lack of support for the downloadable version does hurt me. And I was really hoping,
sure.
I was really hoping to be able to go non-Windows in my workflow for game prep. And that's not happening. I still have to use Windows to run the Monster Builder because I have to have that to do my game prep at this point.
Yeah, I guess I've never relied on it. So I went, you know, I got off boot camp and now I'm just running solely on a Mac, and I have a little HTML table that I use to write in my own monsters, and I just use that. Or I just basically with the Monster Vault and Monster Manual 3 and the Dark Sun creature catalog, I just reskin directly from those, and I rarely even print a stat block anymore.
I do. So it messes with me, and I know Tracy doesn't use the Monster Builder because she's too good for it. But
what?
It's all in her mind.
I used to use that thing all the time. I used to use it all the time until all the bugs came in, and then I just couldn't stand it anymore.
Yeah, and it did get pretty buggy. But I'm still the ability to be able to search for powers, you know, monster powers rather than pull monsters is essential to my monster creation methodology. Even if I don't use those powers, just to see how they work, to get ideas from,
right,
is huge for me.
Or even just to know, feel comfortable that what you're building matches up with what most of the other powers for that level and role would have.
Yeah, I mean, that's something
I often worry.
Yeah, that's a big deal to me if I'm doing something that the world's going to see. But if it's just for my home campaign, I sort of don't worry about the level so much as, does this feel appropriate for the characters in my game? You know, I've been playing with them now for years. So, and this almost the same characters the whole time. I know the guys pretty darn well. I know what they can handle. So, you know, I get what you're saying, but now that I don't use XP, so I don't really care what the monster's level is, you know, other than it does some of the automatic math for me. So yeah, the web app monster builder, I think a disappointment at best, and I don't know, probably a disappointment at worst too. It's just a disappointment. Does that sound like accurate?
I think so. I mean, if it's integrated with the virtual table, I'll be happier, but I do miss having a real builder.
Well, here, who knows, someday, hopefully. But of course, we're still waiting for the character builder to be feature complete, aren't we?
Yeah, that's never gonna happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me because I'm a web developer, and I can kind of understand what's going on, but that doesn't necessarily excuse it either. So I'm just gonna have a hard time discussing it sometimes because of that. But I think they need something with the monsters in order to get virtual table to work.
Right.
And that's probably what happened. I mean, guessing, totally guessing.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's the case, and you know better than I do about web development, but that was sort of my hunch on the whole thing. All right, let's move on. The old D&D comics. From, what was it, the 80s? We mentioned in our comic book episode that those were coming out in a collected form. And the first set of them is out. The Forgotten Realms Classics, I think is what it's called, has been released. It is available. Mine is on its way from Amazon shortly. Forgotten Realms Classics Volume 1 is what it's called, yep. And then they will have the second collection coming out soon called just Dungeons & Dragons Classics Volume 1. Which comes out, what's the ship date? I want to say it's in May. So people that are interested in going back and looking at some classic D&D comic book material, I'm personally curious to see how it goes. I look back at that era, and I remember those comics fondly. But how much of that is nostalgia, and how much of it is those were good comics?
No idea.
Mike, did you ever...
Yeah,
you're not a comic reader either?
No, I'm a big comic reader, but I never read the D&D stuff. I like superheroes.
Yeah, I am too. But I mean, there's some big names attached to that Forgotten Realms comic. Not only is it written by Jeff Grubb, who's legendary in the D&D world, but it was also worked on by Rags Morales.
Mm.
All right. Well, I see that that's got the whole D&D world all a Twitter.
Yes, because Mike is the whole of D&D world.
No, but Mike and Tracy are.
Yeah, right.
No.
I suppose it's time to start talking to Mike.
Yes, but before we take time to talk to Mike about his latest project, let's talk about our first sponsor of the episode, Noble Knight Games, a game store that specializes in finding you whatever you want, even if it's out of print. Our pick for this episode is Death's Reach, a first epic tier adventure from Wizards of the Coast. Available for under $19 at Noble Knight. That's $6 off, and that's for a new copy. Get a gently used copy, and it's an even bigger discount.
Mike, did you run that one?
Yeah, I did. That was our... is that the first epic tier one?
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's right before Kingdom of the Ghouls. So yeah, I ran that one, and yeah, I liked it a lot. It's a good adventure. I mean, and you know, we'll talk more about this, I guess, as we go, but... like all of the adventures that are out, you have to fix all of the monster math in it. But the story was cool. I ran that one almost directly from the book with just some extra story elements that I threw in. And then Kingdom of the Ghouls, I changed quite a bit of it. I cut off entire sections because I wanted to run that adventure pretty quickly. And then Prince of Undeath, I changed almost everything because I wasn't really crazy about where that adventure went. But Death's Reach was really kind of a monumental beginning to the end of my entire campaign. It really started the whole final push for what was going on.
Cool. So I'm glad of all the epic tier adventures. That's the one I randomly grabbed as the sample.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Good.
And Kingdom of the Ghouls is good too.
Okay. And people can check that out at Noble Knight. Links in the show notes.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
First, we probably should recap a little bit, and just who is this Mike Shea?
Yeah, who is this Mike Shea? Were you asking?
I think Mike Shea's a drunk who lives down the street from me and always begs for change.
Yeah. No, I just beg for attention on Twitter. I am a 37-year-old web developer slash manager type living in Vienna, Virginia. I've been gaming for, I don't know, 25 years. Is that right? No. Yeah, 22, 23 years. Second edition through third edition and fourth edition. I ran fourth edition since the day Keep of the Shadowfell came out, and I ran all 9 of the published adventures, the original H1 through E3 series, and paid particular attention to the epic tier, where a lot of people, you know, I was lucky enough to have a game that ran the entire, every Wednesday we played for like 3 years. And we made a lot of progress, which meant that there were a few other people who ran epic stuff, but I don't know if there were many people who ran an entire campaign from 1 to 30 like that. So I learned a lot about the epic tier and a lot of the failings of how 4E handles the epic tier, from at least initially, and had a lot of experiences, and I wanted to share those. And so I wrote a book called Sly Flourishes Running Epic Tier D&D Games, which has all the tips that I had picked up running that campaign after. I mean, we spent about a year in Epic, so it was like 50 sessions or so in the Epic tier. And I still love the Epic tier. I'm a huge fan of it. I love these giant, you know, world universe changing games. I've always loved the biggest monsters that you can find. Orcus has always been a favorite of mine since I was a kid. So it was really nice to be able to run through that and actually have them fight Orcus and all of that. So that's me.
Right on. So you mentioned briefly in the title of your new book that you seem to be associated with this thing called Sly Flourish. Can you update us? What's going on over at slyflourish.com these days?
So I'm pretty much keeping the site up, doing the same things that it's been doing. I write an article every week on Mondays, released first thing in the morning, so you can go to work and get your coffee and sit there and waste your first half hour of your day reading about D&D on your boss's dime. I actually have to go hit the site to see what I've written recently. The most recent thing is I posted a free-to-download adventure that I ran at PAX East along with Mrs. Tracy Hurley. Mine was called Grave Mist, and it was a three-battle adventure that didn't win, but it's still a very good adventure, and I'm offering that up for free. I've got another adventure, the Dark Sun or a Gamma World adventure that I'm going to release in a couple of weeks, and this coming Monday, which may be out by the time this comes out, I have a How to Survive a Gaming Convention guide. Which, you know, I've been to about 6 or 7 of these now, and I thought it was time to kind of write down the things somewhat as a reminder to myself, but also, you know, tips for other people that I've picked up on how to, you know, how to find food, how to stay healthy, how to have the most fun you can have, and how not to go crazy trying to maintain a schedule that's totally, you know, totally ridiculous. So that'll be coming out on Monday.
Cool.
And I think that's about it for the site, yeah.
So, I mean, you mentioned that you have this epic tier book, but you also have another book that you did before, right?
Yeah, Sly Flourish's Dungeon Master Tips, which is kind of if I consider like both of the books are kind of intermediate and advanced. You know, Sly Flourish's Dungeon Master Tips is somebody who's read the DMG and has run a dozen games or so and kind of, you know, knows the mechanics and knows how the game is supposed to run, but things are just not quite as smooth at the table as they could be. You know, their story, they find themselves spending a whole lot of time on stuff that ends up not really affecting the game, you know, and they spend a lot of time in preparation in areas that really aren't having a big impact. So the book is to kind of say, here are, you know, here's how you ought to, here's one way to think about how to build your game. Here's some tricks to preparing and getting the game to run smoother than you would expect. And then here's some things you can do at the table to make the game run smoother. So that's kind of an intermediate book. And then running Epic Tier Games is kind of the advanced book of, okay, we figure that you have now run maybe not hundreds of games, but dozens and dozens and dozens of games. And you're about to head into the Epic Tier and you don't really know what's there. And you've seen what happened in Paragon. And in Paragon, you watched the characters kind of reach a point where it's really hard for you to challenge them. And now you really want to take the gloves off and show them what hell is like. And this book is to help you build hell for them.
Very cool. And you've already talked a little bit about the Epic Tier book. And we should also point out that your Dungeon Master's Tips book is being offered in our contest going on right now. We'll talk more about how to enter for this month at the end of the episode. But you have generously offered to give the three winners each a PDF copy of that fantastic book. So thank you very much for that.
With your permission, I'd be happy to throw copies of Running Epic Tier Games in there as well.
Done. You hear that, people? You can get two awesome Sly Flourish books.
It wasn't out when the contest first came out, so I couldn't offer something I didn't have.
Sure.
But now it's out and I have it, and I'd be happy to throw it into the pool.
And it's good. I've given it my seal of approval.
Awesome.
Totally.
Now, before Mike and Tracy and I talk about building an epic story, I want to introduce a new mini segment for the show called Aberrant Rules by Riven Sedriel. It used to be a little segment that he did on the Power Source podcast, but he and I have talked and it's recently made the move here. But I'll let Riven explain more about it to you in his segment.
I'm Riven Sedriel, RPG commentator and resident astrologer for GeeksDreamGirl.com, and you're caught in the thrall of Aberrant Rules. This is Aberrant Rules, where we bend, twist, and stretch the standard 4th edition D&D rules to give your players a unique and interesting game experience. This is episode 29 of Aberrant Rules. Wait, 29? But I've never been on the Tome before, and y'all never heard of me, have you? Well, allow me a brief explanation. This segment began on the Power Source podcast, which was also a member of the Vorpal Network, but has since dwindled off with Power Source shutting down. It's high time Aberrant Rules underwent a foul resurrection, though, so here we are, leeching off the brains of Jeff, Tracy, and the gang. Brains. At the end of episode 28, way back when, I promised to talk about making monster races playable, and son of a gun, I'm going to stick to it. So let's say you've got that guy, or gal, in your group. Yes, that guy. The one who wants to play a beholder, or a gargoyle, or something crazy, and he, or she, just will not stand for a reskinned normal PC race. Level adjustments made this possible in 3rd edition, but such a standardized rule simply isn't available for 4e. Can you as a DM cater to your players' desires without losing your hair or the rest of your group in frustration? Why, yes you can, in fact. In the next 3 minutes or so, I'll show you how to do it. Let's go gargoyle for the moment, since that idea strikes me as being amusing. What does a race entail? Well, we need stat bumps, skill bonuses, a racial encounter power, and a few racial traits to make this work. Run! Do not walk to whatever updated monster builder you happen to have handy, and look up anything with gargoyle in the name. I pick up about a dozen entries or so doing this, ranging from level 7 to 27. Awesome. Starting with stats, we see that all gargoyles have crazy good strength, so that becomes the race's first bump stat. Beyond that, monsters seem to do alright in anything but intelligence, but Dex and Con appear to be the next two runners-up, so our gargoyle race will have +2 strength, and then +2 to either Con or Dex. Next, we look through the skills and see that nearly every gargoyle monster is trained in stealth and many in athletics. These will be our racial skill bumps. Now before someone says something, yes, monsters are more likely to be trained in physical skills like athletics or endurance than, say, history or religion. So PC race variants created this way will be somewhat skewed. It just is what it is. Powers and traits are a little bit trickier, but not terribly so. What do all gargoyle monsters seem to do? Well, they all fly, most turn to stone, and quite a few grab. This will be the basis of our racial powers and traits. We certainly don't want PCs flying around at will, so let's make that the racial power. Once per encounter, a gargoyle can fly at speed +2, since monster gargoyles usually have speed 6, fly 8, as a move action or as part of a charge. It's simple to adjudicate and gives the players that significant swoop factor that gargoyles are so well known for. Toss in a +2 racial bonus to grab attempts and resist 2 to untyped damage while bloodied at heroic tier, 3 at paragon, 5 at epic, and we're done. Put this on a note card, hand it to your player, and send him away to finish the character. That wasn't so bad, was it? And if you're cool with that, shoot me an email at rivensedril@gmail.com, because I've got an idea for a Blink Dog PC I'm just dying to try out. If you like what you hear in this episode, check out the back catalog on the Atwill blog, or on iTunes, since this segment actually has its own RSS feed. Next time, the topic du jour nowadays, speeding up 4E combat. Hopefully it's still du jour then as well. For more tips, tricks, and inspirations to make your 4th edition game the best it can be, check out the dynamic duo of D&D dispensations, temporaryhitpoints.com and 4eatwill.net, bringing you the best in fan-generated content for both sides of the DM screen. And remember, the next best thing to adoration is aberration.
Alright, so let's go ahead and see if Mike knows his stuff here. One of the things you talk about in your in the Epic Tier book is that Epic Tier games need to have Epic Tier stories. So let's delve into that a little bit and see if you can epicify my campaign, and that'll be a way for people to get some ideas about how to epicify their campaigns. I've only just recently reached at the Epic Tier. We've run exactly one session at 21st level, so they're still brand new to the tier. And so, you know, on a side note, if you're one of my players, this is where you start fast-forwarding. So, Mike, I'm going to let you run the show here and talk to me and ask me questions, and Tracy can chime in and tell me how to epicify my game, or my Epic Tier games here.
Well, where did you end the Paragon tier? How did you end it?
I ended the Paragon tier. There's actually already a lot of story threads sort of begun. There is a war going on between the Forgotten Realms, between Thay and everybody who's not Thay around them. They're just sort of gobbling up territory as part of Zaztam's... Yeah, he's going to reattempt the massive ritual that he failed to become a god, or I've actually described it more of as an over-god, but... he's going to reattempt that, but he needs to be able to. He needs to be able to suck the energy out of more territory, so he's conquering. So that's going on, but that's sort of been in the background. They haven't been directly dealing with that. At the same time, they've just brought an ancient city of star elves to the world. It was sort of stuck in a pocket plane and being devoured by creatures from the far realm, and they've just saved it. That was sort of the big final encounter of Paragon tier. And now it's flying on an Earth mode above the kingdom, and they are the real goal that the PCs have is that they want to bring back Mystra, the goddess of magic, and so Sirik, the evil god who killed her and has been imprisoned for it, actually is trying to help them because by his reckoning, being insane. Is that if she comes back to life, then he couldn't have killed her, so they're going to have to let him go. And so he's given them hints about, you know, where can they find, you know, bits and pieces of her essence scattered throughout the world. And so they're sort of that's the MacGuffin of getting them to travel all over the world and go to interesting places and do interesting things.
Right.
What more do you want to know?
No, that's a good start. Do they have a home base now? And do you feel that home base is epic-y enough?
I suppose I could have mentioned this. They spent most of the Paragon tier trying to repair an airship. There's only 5 airships in the entire world of the Forgotten Realms that survived the spell plague. And so they found another one that that just couldn't fly, you know? So they spent most of a Paragon tier getting it to fly again. And so the conclusion of, yay, we saved the city of Star Elves and now it's flying above the world, was that the airship was done and flew up and met them. So they have a mobile base of operations. They've also recently acquired an ancient cathedral that needs a lot of repair in Aglarond, but that they seem to be having a lot of fun with. But I don't know how much they're going to use it as a base of operations, but it's there as well.
What was described the city again that they saved? Was it an Earth mode city?
It was originally in a pocket dimension being eaten up by the Far Realm. And what they did is they collapsed the pocket dimension and moved it into the world. And so I decided that it would be an Earthmote city flying over, floating over the forests of Aglarond.
Yes, that's a good I mean, that, like, it's, you know, the potential could be that they have a home base that's that city, and now they are, you know, everybody knows who they are. Everybody recognizes them as the heroes that they are, that they are for fighting back the Far Realm. And they have, you know, that city is theirs. Like, instead of just having a bar that they hang out in or whatever, they've actually got, you know, a castle or whatever. They have their own place that's there that they can go back to and rest at. Like, and the airship can be their transportation, and it can be kind of a mini, you know, kind of a mini base that they can kind of move wherever they want to move. But the idea, when I'm thinking about it, you know, so one of the things I talk about in the book is thinking of epic tier characters as superheroes rather than heroes. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of, like, Green Lantern's satellite, you know, that he's got a satellite that orbits the planet that he lives in, you know, and then he can kind of get where he needs to get at from this satellite. So I kind of like the idea, you know, an Earth mote that's not, you know, they probably don't rule it necessarily, but, you know, they're pretty well known there. Mm-hmm. Might be a good epic feeling for a base.
Yeah.
You know, that could be a good spot. And I don't know if you're, you know, depending on how your group wants change or anything like that, that might be a good home base to have for the whole rest of the campaign. So they always know they can go back there. They always know they have it. It's a comfort, you know, it's comfortable to them. They're happy when they know that they're returning there. But it still feels massive. Like, they wouldn't be embarrassed showing up there when they're 28th level or whatever.
Okay, cool. I can get behind that. A lot of that, I guess, I've sort of decided they've got several possible places they can basically dock, you know, to make their own. And that's definitely one of the ones they've been hanging out at lately. So,
I mean, it's probably good for them to pick which one they want to pick. But at that point, you know, kind of getting them to focus on that one and recognize that that's their home base, it's going to make it easier for you. You know, it kind of gives you the hub world from, like, video games and computer games, and it, you know, gives them, you know, more details can be filled out for that area, and then they really start to feel like it's their place.
I can get behind that. Let's talk.
Is Zastam going to be your main boss? Sorry.
Yeah. I sort of have, when I started the campaign, you know, 2 weeks after 4th edition came out, I kind of had a vague idea of what I wanted to do with the campaign, but I wasn't exactly sure. He was going to be – Zastam was always going to be the main villain. And then mm-hmm.
He's a good one.
Yeah, and then when the Forgotten Realms book came out, I sort of – when I was reading through it, a story just appeared to me. Like, I read it, and it's like they've clearly already written the story of a campaign right here. It was just obvious to me as I read it what my story was going to be. And so I've had a vision of how the campaign ends pretty much since level 3. And that fight with Zastam at the end is part of it, although both Bane and Orcus play a role.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you want to have some, you know, like, I think it's useful to have that kind of end goal of, okay, I know things are going to end up here. You know, exactly how the campaign is going to end, you might change your mind later, so you want to be flexible to be able to change your mind, even if it's still in the same place.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you could, and I think, I mean, I really, one of the things I like to do is always make sure that big things always have a choice, and that choice is always equally big. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the end of my epic tier campaign, one of them had to sacrifice themselves in death, you know, irrecoverably to save somebody, and who were they, or they were not, you know, or nobody would, and then that would, you know, make a completely different story. So, you know, they had to make this choice of, okay, are we gonna save, you know, the Raven Queen? Are we gonna save the Raven Queen or not? And if we are, who's gonna do it? And whoever does it, we're never gonna see you again. So that's kind of a, you know, it's a rough conclusion, but it's an interesting one. I liked it and the way it ended up. Of course, my wife was the one who sacrificed herself, and so
poor her.
That put some strain in our relationship. But yeah, you know, so. Well, no, I mean, there's a whole other little sub-adventure that she's not really dead. She's in the Far Realm, and she has to make her way back, and she'll be all Dark Willow style. So so I think having Zastam, you know, you might have the other folks too, and you might have them kind of touch on it, but kind of having that, you know, giving them that goal early on, particularly when you're just starting the epic tier and saying, okay, you have 9 levels left, and those 9 levels are leading you to this guy. And, you know, we all, I think we have a tendency to try to write stories with lots of twists and turns and lots of, you know, big whodunits and let's change it. Let's put everything on its head. But sometimes it's nice to just say, you know, this is where you're headed. And, you know, it's up to you guys to figure out how you're going to get there. But that's the goal. And things may change on the way. And there may be other little twists on the side, but you're still, you know, doing it.
Yeah, I think my players figured out at about level four that they knew Zaztan would be the final villain. I think they've known it from almost the beginning. That's been pretty obvious to them because
Orcus was the known.
The campaign started, you know, as slaves in Thay, so they quickly figured out that was going to be a central point. They knew they couldn't take him on then, so they've been waiting for the day that they could eventually work their way back to him.
Uh-huh.
Now, I have
here's
my struggle, I guess, for making my epic tier sessions epic-y enough, is that when I'm plotting out my individual sessions, I don't know that the conclusions, you know, the results of the PCs going out and doing what they're doing feels epic to me, but the actual things they're doing in the in-between sometimes still feels like similar things to what I did in Paragon. You know, for example... Mm-hmm. I'm working on my session for this weekend, and I've got them going off, you know, having followed one of Sirik's clues, they're going off to find a bit of Mistra's essence to try to, you know, work on bringing her back. And in doing so, I sort of thought, well, they're going to get mixed up with some local nobility and getting access to the vault where they think this essence is at. You know, the Order of Blue Fire might get involved. There's going to be some plague-changed monsters to deal with, and all of it's sort of being guided by this little girl who's been trapped inside of the essence all along. And the monsters are really just out there subconsciously trying to find her friends and family, but inadvertently have killed them all. You know, and so I feel like, I feel like the conclusion of the whole thing is actually really cool because, you know, they obviously don't know this, but I plan on this little girl becoming a woman who has been appearing to them in visions later, and that, you know, at the conclusion of the campaign, she, you know, becomes, you know, an angel or whatever of the god or goddess of magic, whatever ends up happening, and going back in time and sort of setting them on this path from the beginning, you know? So, you know, the results are very epic, but they're still going and dealing with nobles and fighting monsters and getting into dungeons and that kind of stuff. Is that epic-y enough, or is it the results that really matter?
Well, I think all of it needs to be. You know, I mean, it's fine to have like, well, the overall goal is certainly epic, but you know, even I mean, everything that they should do should feel different. You know, and of course, everything I talk about comes with the caveat that you know, it works. It's fine for me. It works for my group, and it works for me. But it may not be what you want. But you know, I mean, it's in mine. It's like, well, you don't go into a room that's got, you know, a fountain and the water's tainted. You go into a room and there's blood pouring out on the floor, and if you touch it, you're gonna die. You know, it's got to be way kind of over the top in every possible way. And that's a little hard when you're running in a known campaign setting like Forgotten Realms, because your choice is either they stay in the realms, which is by default kind of a heroic place. Now, you know, it's heroic / paragon, or they go to the outer planes, which are clearly epic. And, you know, mine, it was like from the get-go, it was okay. They go to the Feywild and the Shadowfell when they're in Paragon, and then they go into the outer planes, the Abyss. They spend almost, you know, 8 levels in the Abyss. Mm-hmm. And the Abyss gives you as much room as you want to be as crazy as you want, you know, mile high waterfalls of, you know, demonic blood and scream, you know, mountains that are screaming and all kinds of crazy stuff that you can do there. But if you want to stay in the realms, you know, it's going to be tougher to find epic stuff that they're accomplishing. Like, yeah, if they're sitting and negotiating with local lords about going into a vault, not that I'm bashing your story.
No, absolutely.
But I mean, these guys are beyond human, right? They don't talk to local lords. You know, local lords come begging to them and they say, sorry, it's not a big enough deal for me. So I don't know if it's the kind of thing where, you know, if the sub-villains that are kind of dealing with, I mean, you said that you have kind of Bane and Orcus and Sirik that are behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. If there's some way to have like avatars of Bane and Styrek and Orcus that are the antagonists in the land, but they are, you know, they're really bad, right? I mean, if they're fighting an avatar of Bane, that feels, you know, that feels epic. I mean, I remember, I can't remember the books, but there was a series of Forgotten Realms novels about, you know, it was when Bane died and Styrek became the new, you know, god of death or whatever. And I remember like thinking, wow, I mean, they had, I mean, Bane was a dude who was walking around and they talked about how Bane was killed. And when he was, it was like a nuclear bomb went off, you know, it completely destroyed like an entire city when he died. And, you know, and I thought, okay, well, that's pretty epic. You know, that's a big storyline for a place like the Forgotten Realms where it's normally, you know, Drizzt goes and fights some, you know, Yetis or whatever. So, you know, so I think that that can be epic. You might think of it a little bit like, I mean, I'm playing a lot of Dark Sun now, so I'm thinking a lot about Dark Sun, but the idea of the Sorcerer Kings, you know, hunting Sorcerer Kings is certainly an epic level thing. So if but instead of Sorcerer Kings, you have these avatars that have come to, you know, if you can't bring like the Abyss and the Nine Hells to, you know, if you're not going to bring your characters to the Abyss and the Nine Hells, you might bring the Abyss and the Nine Hells into the Forgotten Realms. And now the Forgotten Realms starts to feel like more of an epic place, and the guys that they're dealing with are people, you know, they should be dealing with the gods at this point.
Absolutely.
You know, not local lords.
So here's my thoughts on how to take the story that I've got going on and merge it with some of the ideas that you're sharing here. On one hand, I do have a little bit of, you know, yeah, you can do some pretty crazy things going to the Outer Planes, right? I have the excuse of anywhere that they're going in the realms is a place they're going in the realms because it has these really insane, crazy magic things going on with spell plague and the essence of Mistress. So I can still pull some pretty crazy things. I agree about how to handle the deal with the local lords, but part of the goal, I mean, they're on an airship. So travel, getting around the world is really simple for them, and they need to be able to move around the world to accomplish what they want to do.
Right.
And part of the goal is, or part of my idea, or my GMing style or whatever, is that I like to use that as an excuse to sort of infuse some different culture, you know, and what have you. And that's harder, I think, to do on an epic level. But I wonder if could I have them deal with local lords because there is an aspect of Bane, an avatar of Bane that is manipulating that situation.
Yeah, if they know it,
then
right.
I guess it
comes up to like what the threat is.
Yeah, but then does it become epic enough if they realize that it's not just dealing with local lords, but it's also dealing with the fact that Bane himself is there trying to block you from getting access?
Yeah, I mean it has to manifest itself somehow.
Yeah,
you know, they have to kind of recognize that this, you know, overweight fop in silks in front of them is actually, you know, a weapon of, you know, Bane.
And I think I can maybe ring in a lot of that though. You know, sort of announce that, you know what, the world is at risk because of what Zazham is doing. This ritual that he's conducting has begun at the beginning of your epic tier now. And I sort of can change the whole tenor of the world and have insane and hugely powerful things like that happening in the world as a result of what Zazham is doing. That, you know, then I can – the whole world becomes more epic. Everything's at risk. Mass devastation. And that's fine. I'm okay with, you know, destroying the world. And it also gears us back towards that final conclusion. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, I always feel like I'm, you know, mucking around in someone else's medicine cabinet whenever I tell them what they ought to be doing in their adventures and what they ought to do in their campaign, because it's really going to depend upon your group and you and what you want. But so that said, and I apologize for mucking around in your medicine cabinet.
That's what we're here for.
Another potential option is if all of this, you know, all of this stuff is coming to pass, and if you kind of think about it from, you know, the gods' point of view, the Forgotten Realms is a little pinpoint, right? It's a point of light in the giant thing of darkness, to use the wizard's metaphor for it. But they might realize, oh, on that pinpoint of light, a lot of stuff is happening right now. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in the universe, but it seems to be starting there. So if all of the gods say, you know, we need to be paying more attention to that place there, and you know, the Pantheon comes down to Toril, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Pantheon comes to Toril. Now that Noble Lord is actually, you know, the voice piece for, you know, name you know, pick your god of choice.
Yeah.
And now they're not, you know, they're not, and the gods all have different motivations, right? They may be like, look, we don't want you in our vaults any more than anybody because you're going to bring stuff out that you shouldn't be bringing out.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to give more power to Zastam instead of less. Why would we trust mortals to this? You know, and then you're like, well, we're not mortals. We're, you know, we're better than that. And then they might give them tests and everything else. But now you kind of have them mucking around in the Pantheon, having to negotiate with a god.
Mm.
You know, and it might be through the eyes of the Noble Lord,
mm-hmm.
you know, they might realize, well, that the avatar that he's using is this noble, but I know that behind this noble is actually, you know, Torm or whoever.
Right. So here's what I'm thinking to go with that, because I mean, that some of that story has already been told, right? That series that you were talking about, where Bane dies, is all about the avatars of the gods mm-hmm. coming down. But a lot of the players,
yeah, right. That's what I was
thinking about. A lot of the players have actually been approached by gods as they entered their epic destiny and are working for some of the gods.
Oh, okay.
So what if
right.
what if the you know they're just
more
the PCs are just some of the agents of the gods, and other people have also, you know, all the right. gods have taken notice of what's going on, and they've also chosen champions that might have opposing ideologies.
Right.
Good. I like that idea.
Yeah, see, that's great. So now you have this idea that there's these other epic tier people that are walking around that are just as blessed as the players are, and could be just as tough as the players are, and have, you know, sometimes their goals might align, sometimes they might be completely opposed, and sometimes they might, you know, they might be just perpendicular to one another. And now you got areas of gray, and I always love gray areas in a story like that. Like, they have to beat down a guy, but or whatever, they have to get something that this guy doesn't want to get, but he's not a bad guy. He's a good guy doing it for the right reasons. And, you know, to me, a good villain always has absolutely in their minds just reasons for why they're doing what they're doing. So that I think there's a lot of potential there.
Right on. Well, I hope that helps other people as well understand how you need to shift your story when you move to epic tier. Because I think the idea that I had originally works really well both in heroic and in paragon tier. But
sure.
As you get into epic, I think you're right. Adding that extra element of these aren't just people, these aren't just lords, these are agents of the gods themselves. You know, I think that adds a whole new element to it that makes the whole thing feel more epic. So we'll see how it goes.
Right.
So we've been talking about story for a bit. So why don't we talk about some general epic tier advice for players and DMs alike?
But first, it's time to mention our second sponsor, the Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits. For $16 on Amazon, you can get 110 pages of charts and optional rules for making critical hits and critical failures, something truly memorable in your game. Brought to you by Unknown Tome, a small publisher that also wrote the adventure Trial of Underkeep, available for $20 on Amazon. This adventure takes a bit of an interesting take on exploring the lair of a mad mage as you go into a castle that has been buried under a mountain for centuries. You can find links to both of these in the show notes.
The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits from Unknown Tome Publishing. A 4th edition D&D supplement for all levels, featuring 63 new unique treasures, including 6 item sets and 28 new hazards and terrain powers. The Devious Book of Fumbles and Crits will have you critting and fumbling your way into D&D gold. Visit our website to pick up this product in print or as a PDF.
So now it's time to talk some epic tips outside of story. So let's start with some stuff for the players. What do players need to know when they enter epic level?
Well, who wants to start first? Tracy, have you run or played in epic games?
I haven't even done really Paragon yet, so no.
Okay. So Mike and I are the experts on what players need to do for epic tier games, huh?
Yeah.
Do you want to start or should I, Mike?
I can bring up a few things and you can chime in when you've you know, if you've seen similar things.
Okay.
you know, I always have to laugh that you brought the guy who is, you know, DM'd games. I mean, you know, for the record, I have never played in an Epic tier game. I've only ever run them. So there's going to be a little bit of bias in some of the things I'll discuss, things that I kind of wish players would do sometimes. But I also think there's a few important things that players should do on their own. And most of mine are mechanical, not really story based. They're more about how to run a character or how to you know, improve running a character. A big one is knowing what your character is capable of and how they work and how all of the combinations work, and know how they work within the group. If you've been playing for a lot of levels with the same characters, you should have picked this up on the way, but it's always important to kind of know what the synergies are between you and everybody else. And there can be this kind of thing where you don't even have to turn to your left to know that you're about to get a big bonus to your attack scores when you use an action point. Or, you know that it's okay if you drop to zero because this other guy's got this other thing that can help you recover almost immediately. When you know the capabilities of other players, the efficiency of the entire group goes up significantly. So that's certainly something worth knowing. Is that something you've seen in your group, Jeff?
Yeah, see, my group actually is a lot like me. My players are a lot like me when I'm a player, in that there's a bit of showmanship going on, I think. You know, I've got a cool power that it's going to let you do something cooler. It's going to save the day if this happens to you or whatever. But I may not tell you about it because I want to have that showmanship of, ha-ha, look at what I've done. You didn't expect that, did you? You know?
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily good strategy, but it is fun. So if you can survive it, you know, what my players end up doing a lot of times is they pull those things. And so a lot of times they do get close to death or close to losing or whatever, and then pull it off in the end. And so they still manage to scrabble together those wins and those strategies, but it takes them a lot longer at the table to pull that off. You know, they don't know what exactly to expect all the time,
right,
or whatever. And so it does make combats take a little bit longer. It makes that whole process a little lengthier. So they pull it off.
Right.
You know, I found out last time when I took a 28th level solo and threw it against my 21st level PCs and planned on having it run away when it got bloodied, and they beat it. You know, they actually got it negative. You know,
yeah.
I found out that they can surprise you.
Wow.
They can pull it off. But
yep, that's an interesting level range. They fought a 28th level solo at level 21.
Yeah.
Oh man, and they beat it.
Well, it helped.
Theoretically, the math shouldn't even work. They shouldn't be able to hit it.
It was a lot of auto damage because they managed to sort of nail it down, and then the ranger double critted with his bow.
Yeah.
In the last couple of rounds.
You're going to see a lot of crit.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Is anything like mine?
We'll
get into that in the DM section.
I'm starting to see some of that, yep.
So one of the other things I was going to talk about that I think relates to what you were discussing, and something that I've actually done at all levels when I play, is on my character sheet, I will write a lot of notes on the power cards. Not a lot of notes, because you want to keep it clear, but like with a Sharpie, I will write the triggering effect and the type of trigger for interrupts, which becomes a much bigger deal in Epic tier. You know, characters have a lot of interrupts at that point. And it's easy for players to forget that they have interrupts. So, you know, I'll often say like, when hit, you know, avoid damage, or when, you know, when based, not to use a D&D miniatures term, when based slide 5. And that way the circumstance for the trigger and the result of the circumstance, or the result of the instance, you know, it's a lot easier to see. And from the, you know, to the courtesy of the dungeon master, you don't want to make those big surprises for the DM, because the DM is usually trying to move pretty quickly. And when you throw the flag in the center of the table, you might do it too late and the DM's already moved on to the next thing. And they're like, wait, I actually wanted to interrupt that first attack, and you know, oh God, I got to roll back 5 attacks now, and there's all this damage that was thrown out. We already did everything, and now you're telling me you have an interrupt.
Right.
So it's important. Like, you know, you might want to, I'm not sure my players would agree with this, but if you tell the DM, by the way, these are some of the interrupts that I have, and these are the circumstances where I'm going to use it, a good DM will remember that and say, hey, he's attacking you. Are you going to
use that?
Are you going to interrupt it?
Mm-hmm.
And that way it doesn't hurt that flow. Robert Schwab wrote a article about interrupts that got a lot of attention on how interrupts interrupt the game, funny enough. or how immediate reactions, immediate, what do they call them, triggering actions, how they kind of break the flow of a narrative. And it doesn't have to be that way if the DM knows to weave it into the narrative in the first place. So, but jotting down those notes, you know, jotting down any circumstantial modifiers, jotting down any feat things, you know, and what I do is I write it with a big Sharpie right on the power card. So it's a lot easier to read than that tiny little, you know, 6-point font that says immediate interrupt when, you know, reduced to 0 hit points or whatever.
Yeah, and that's good. That's a good idea as well. That's because that's one of the things I see from my players a lot. They don't wait and then make me go back and retcon things or whatever. But instead, they use their interrupt powers to literally interrupt me as I'm in the middle of doing mental math and things as a DM. They'll be like, oh, no, wait, I do this.
Yeah.
And it's like, let me finish what I'm doing. You know, let me finish a thought.
And it can actually go both ways because there are times where monsters have triggering actions and, you know, the player is trying to move quickly and the player grabs, you know, a handful of dice and throws it out and says, okay, I fire, you know, I throw three daggers, and you're like, well, he's going to be fading away after the first. And you're like, I already rolled all this stuff. So sometimes, like, there's a feeling that you should be rolling all of your dice together, and I'm not always sure that's accurate. I think sometimes it's okay to just roll each of your attacks independently, because it's particularly for interrupts, because it leaves time for people to say, I want to interrupt that one. Sorry, I've been interrupting everybody.
But I'm bummed.
Even without being in the picture, I know what you're talking about. It gets crazy after a while.
Yeah, so I mean, I think if you have the chance, start that habit early of just sort of knowing what they have available. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of players, and sometimes I think even mine, don't want to tell me about what new cool powers they have or new strategies they have or whatever, because they're afraid I'm going to then I'm going to plan for it and stop
right.
it.
Right, you're going to game it. Yeah,
Sometimes I might. But then sometimes I'm going to purposely let you do that because it's cool, you know?
Yeah, trigger it.
I'm going
to say that. That's a good way to get their attention. That's a good way to get their trust. Is like if when they tell it to you, go ahead and trip it and say, yeah, he doesn't know you do that. And let them get their, I mean, they got those powers for a reason and they didn't get them so that the monsters could avoid them. So give them the opportunity to use them as from a DM's point of view.
Yeah, I do it almost every session. Especially with my ranger PC or player, who has a feat that allows him to attack anytime somebody attacks his beast. He's a Beastmaster Ranger.
Right.
And so I will pull off at least one time every encounter every session, you know, just to be like, okay, fine, I'll attack your stupid lizard and you can get off your free attack. And now they've learned their lesson, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that can get really bad in Epic tier because some of those like freebie attacks and some of like the, you know, the triggering actions and stuff like that, they get so nutty that they break, you know, I call it the economy of actions, right? That there's a certain economy of actions that the round has. And, you know, the economy of action for a player is essentially you get your move, your minor, your standard and an interrupt, but they get a lot of effects that start to break the economy of actions. They get a lot of free action stuff. They get a lot of, you know, no action stuff, or, you know, they could be unconscious and 50 miles away and the monster's still dying because of something that they put on it. So I have three other quick player things that I'd like to throw out. So one is to try to, and these are kind of more courtesy. One of them is as a player, you really ought to be thinking about your resist gear. Because if your dungeon master that's running the Epic tier game is worth their salt, they are going to be pouring damage on you like crazy. So and they are going to expect, I know I expect people to have resist gear. So if I'm throwing any kind of type damage, that type damage is almost always 10 higher than you would expect. And it's because I expect people to be able to resist at least 10, if not more. So good resist gear is something that you really ought to be thinking about for items. Then the two things that are kind of courtesy to the DM, take pride in running a short turn. You know, don't. You know, there's six people at the table and each of them should have an equal amount of time. So don't, you know, it's not like you should have 50% of the time for whatever awesome thing you're doing. You are a superhero and your character really is, you know, demigodly. That doesn't mean you should be able to spend 5 minutes on your turn. It means that, you know, take pride in the fact that you are able to know what you're going to do before your turn starts, roll your dice when your turn goes, finish the actions and pass the torch to the next player as fast as you can. to keep the game smooth. And I know when I play, that's how I play. I try to take pride in the fact that I can run my whole turn in 15 seconds. So that's one. Then, you know, the other one is to try to, if you're, one thing you can do to kind of help the game run smooth, and it also helps you run your character if you find yourself getting lost in all the possible things. Because I think you get like, I think at last count, you get 3,000 feats by the time you're level 28. So trying to figure out what all of those feats could potentially, I think it's like 21 or so. It's a lot of feats that you get. Pick a lot of the feats that give you always on effects. You know, the feats that boost your defenses, you know, the feats that, you know, your all of your various weapon training feats that give you just static bonuses to your attack and damage scores, you know, grab all of those and don't try to grab every feat that adds another power or every feat that lets you multiclass into something else or every feat that has some circumstantial bonus that you now have to remember every time. And now you have to interrupt the game and go, oh, I totally forgot that I have +2 when I'm getting hit by titans that are using lightning clubs.
Yeah.
You know, too much of a pain.
That's what I do. That's what I do as a player. As a player, anytime I can grab a feat that is just a static bonus, I grab it because so often I just forget that it's there and I don't want to be a pain and bring it up late, you know, after the fact.
Exactly. Yeah. And pick two or three interesting ones, but generally your feats should be just shoring up all of the things that, you know, monsters get for free, right? So, I mean, whenever I'm building a character, I always throw in all the static ones and it's just, it's, you know, at least half of the feats that I'll choose are the static bonus feats. And now with Essentials, those feats are even better, and they scale up over levels and everything like that. So they're pretty good.
Tracy, you had a thought?
I was just going to continue on with the absurdity of some of them. Like, only when you step on standing on your right foot with your sword in your left hand or something, like, do you get the bonus?
I hate those, yeah.
I mean, some of them are okay for story, but by Epic Tier, I don't know if they're really going to add to your story much.
Yeah, I noticed that as we got into Epic Tiers, we were the characters were sort of comparing what they did and what their characters looked like in the Epic Tier and all that kind of stuff, and it turned out that there are only 2 characters out of my 7 that do not have a multi-class feat. So 5 of them do.
Oh, God.
And one of them used to have multi-class and then trained out of it.
Yeah, how long do your battles take now?
I think because of the way I've been setting them up, I'm still – it depends on the encounter, but I'm probably between 1 hour and 2 hours.
Yeah.
Depending on the fight.
Yeah. That's probably not too uncommon, and particularly when characters have that many. I mean, sometimes those complications can be great. I've got a player who really builds complicated characters every time, but his turns are fast because he's, you know, he's like Rain Man. He knows all of the things that he needs to do every time he's going to do it.
Right.
But then there's other players who are just, they work a lot better when they've got a Slayer, you know, when they just know that, okay, I go up, I roll my basic melee attack. By the way, my basic melee attack does, you know, 7d12 plus 72 damage. But I've already got the math worked out, so it's all ready to go.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, and the only thing I would add to the advice that you've already shared, and mine is a little bit more story-based, is just like we've talked about in the first half of the episode, the DM needs to make sure the games or the stories are epic. I think the players can help with that a lot as well. Make the story of your character truly epic. I made all of my players the week before we started Epic Tier, I made them all tell me what epic destiny they were going to choose ahead of time. And then I sent all of them a little story about how that happened. You know, so if you're going to be a punisher of the gods, well, here's what happens that takes you to that point, you know, because I wanted to get that. I wanted one last big push of story from them as much as I do from me.
Right. That was actually something I did really poorly when I ran my game is I didn't, some of the characters had really good ties to their epic destiny and I'd bring it up a lot. And other ones I really just hand waved. Maybe it was like demigods. You just, yeah, you're like, yeah, you're a demigod. Congrats. And other ones like my wife's thing was God Hunter was her paragon, was her epic destiny. And God Hunter was, you know, a really interesting, I just like the name of it. So that one definitely tied into the whole rest of the story. And, you know, there were a few others that clearly tied into their story, but I didn't do the epic destiny thing. Like at 21, you get this quest that's going to last you till 30. I kind of just let it, you know, they came up as they came up. And I think each character kind of had a good epic moment, but I didn't really do it the kind of epic Destiny quest way.
Yeah, I think for 6 of my 7 characters, I was able to... No, I take that back. For 5 of my 7 characters, I was able to take their epic Destiny and make the quest of the campaign the same as their epic Destiny quest, or at least...
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Closely related. You know, in fact, I helped... Some of them even sent me, you know, I'm thinking of these 5. And I'm like, well, these 2 would work really well with the story. And every time I made a suggestion like that, they picked it.
Yeah.
So shall we move on to talk about some DM tips to make our epic games a little more epic?
Sounds good.
All right. Well, let's not spoil the entirety of your book, because people should definitely go out and buy it. Because it is...
Yeah,
awesome.
I agree.
It is awesome. But let's talk a little bit about what kind of general tips you might give.
So I'll give you a few that aren't necessarily in the book. They're touched on, but I think are pretty important. And some of these are definitely in the book, and some of these are just they're pretty key to, I think, to running a good game. And these are, again, they're a little bit more, they're less story based because we've already talked a lot about epic stories. They're more kind of running the game and how to run it the game and how to run it more efficiently. I think number one and is to don't bother using monsters that were published before the Monster Manual 3. None of the epic tier monsters that are in books previous to that are going to have the right damage expressions. It's mainly damage that's their primary issue, and the damage that they do is not nearly enough to threaten an epic tier group. Epic tier groups will take that kind of damage and walk right through it. So. You know, my favorite books right now, my favorite book is The Monster Vault. I think The Monster Vault is absolutely fantastic. And unfortunately, its number one failing is that it has hardly any epic guys in it. So it won't really help you. But The Monster Manual 3 and The Dark Sun Creature Catalog both have really excellent, you know, the math is right. Their defenses are good. Their ability to deal with status effects is solid. You know, good epic tier monsters. And particularly when you're talking about... your campaign with you know, potentially seeing Bane and potentially seeing Zastam and all of that, you're not like, God help you, please do not use the Zastam stats that are in the Forgotten Realms book.
Right.
I ran him actually for a epic one shot and he died in the first round easily.
Ooh.
Like he didn't do anything. So, you know, but there are like some alternatives is there are a lot of, well, not a lot, but there's a good handful of epic level, big bosses in the Dark Sun Creature Catalog that are very easily reskinned into Forgotten Realms godling types. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started doing that in my game. I used Lalali Pui as the template for Dorisane the Ghoul King, and it worked really well. You know, it worked much better than Dorisane's normal stats in Monster Manual 1. So, you know, I love reskinning. That's how I primarily use the books these days. Is I'll just grab a monster and I'll reskin it and I'll just use it directly out of the book. And but those 3 books, the Monster Vault, the Monster Manual 3, and the Dark Sun Creature Catalog are the ones that you should focus on when you're looking at monster stats for, you know, pretty much across the game, but certainly for epic tier.
Is it Demonomicon is also using the new math?
Yeah, Demonomicon also uses new math. I'm not sure that every creature in there does, but yeah, it's pretty good. There were a couple products that came out the same month where it was clear that like half the monsters in it were done correctly. I guess I think actually the Demonomicon was done almost all right from what I could see. And I think it was an adventure that they had done. The Tomb of Horrors one was like 50-50.
Yeah.
I used a lot of Demonomicon guys in my epic tier game and they ran really well. The big abyssal worms were really nice. So that can work.
So I actually have a quick question about this, though, because I know we were talking about this on Twitter a little bit. You're talking about the stats, but what is it about monsters in epic level that's probably different from maybe Paragon and then Heroic? Because it's more than just, you know, their bonuses to hit and their ability to deal status effects. I think how they, like what the types of things they do is often a little different too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't, certainly with Paragon guys, I don't see a whole lot of difference in some of the things that they do. I mean, you know, the most epic fight I've run in a long time was a level 9 Beholder that you know, tore up my group yesterday. That was epic, right? So, right. And I don't know. I guess I don't see a lot of, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see a lot of mechanical differences.
Well, I thought those epic level PCs often do automatic damage, I thought you were saying earlier.
Yeah, oh, epic PCs, there are huge differences in how they operate.
Right, so if you find the monsters aren't doing enough for you, maybe you add resistances to them. I'm just wondering, I'm just throwing it out there, because I know there's a lot of confusion out there about it.
You know, one of the things I did on that 28th level solo that I was telling you about, one of the things I did is I wanted to try doing some really interesting and different things with it. I actually wrote an article for At Will about it. I'm doing a new series over there. And I got some inspiration from some things in the Epic Tier book, Mike, where you talk about using terrain effects and auras and that kind of stuff to accomplish some new and interesting things. And so this monster, this legendary creature, only had one attack. But he had two auras and an immediate interrupt immediate reaction that happened every time he was attacked, and all three of them did automatic damage. You know, just straight up. If you're near it, you're taking necrotic damage. If you're bloodied, you're taking extra damage, and then if you attack it, you're taking more extra damage. You know, and just straight. So it only had one attack. So when I came to the DM's turn, all I had to do was say, "Okay, it bites you," and then the damage expression was like a D12 plus 50.
Yeah, that'll work. Yeah. I mean, I was gonna say it sounds like it's a giant. It's a big pillar of pain. It doesn't really do anything, but it sure hurts being near it.
Yeah.
I mean, those are, and actually, you mentioned At Will and Quinn over on At Will and the Worldbreaker stuff that he's been doing over time. That, you know, if you want to talk about epic creatures, you know, those are epic. And, you know, that's something that you definitely, and I know he's in the process of writing a book of these world breakers and things like that. And I can't wait to see it, because I think it's going to be pretty fantastic. You know, the idea is like the creature and the environment and the encounter are all one thing. It's not separate. And I think that really get that epic feel. And, you know, a sample of that is like Loth. If you look at Loth in the Monster Manual 3, you know, she changes as you're fighting her. And, you know, other than just, hey, now I do more ongoing damage, which is what I typically do. I just double their aura every time they get bloodied.
But I think that speaks to what Tracy was talking about. That is something different happening with epic level creatures. You know, some of that.
Yeah, I see it with... I mean, I'm doing it with heroic tier creatures now. You know, I like... You know, if it's a solo, I think any solo should do something different when it's bloodied. And you'll see it in Monster Vault. You know, again, I'll go back to that level 9 Beholder, which is now my new favorite creature. It gets 3 I-Ray attacks when it's bloodied instead of 2. And, you know, those I-Ray attacks are really nasty. Mm-hmm. So, and that's level 9. So, you know, I think I wish they scaled up bigger than they do. But you also, you know, if you're a DM, they need to be simple, because you don't have a lot of, you know, you can't put a lot of attention onto these all the time. It's not like a player where you know, you're totally focused on one thing. You know, you've got 7 of these guys that you got to run, and you're going to throw them away as soon as you're done. So, but you mentioned the heavy use of environmental effects and things like that. And one of my big ones is that, you know, using really, I mean, just a way to kind of keep the threat high as they get more and more invulnerable, which they pretty much do, is to really use heavy environmental effects. You know, just throw tons of ongoing damage. You know, make every room they walk into should be filled with acid. And, you know, the monsters they fight might be the easy part. The hard part will be the fact that they're drowning in acid, you know, every time they walk into a new room. I'm kidding, of course, but, you know, trying to, for your tough battles, environmental effects they don't slow the battle down at all. Or very little. They really challenge a party. They're not something that is easily worked around. And they really kind of get people's attention without a lot of extra resource. You don't have to really think about them that much. It sounds like you figured that out when you were building your pillar of pain creature.
Yeah. Well, I got the idea from you. So we're running a little short on time, and we've covered a lot of what I wanted to talk about, but I imagine you have a bullet list of more tips that you wanted to talk about. So I want to give you a chance to do that.
Sure. I'll talk about 2 more things and then I'm done.
Okay.
One is, so you're going to have bosses, right? You've got boss guys that you like, and you're not going to want to watch those bosses. There's an interesting dichotomy in what players want and what DMs want. And I think what I want as a DM is I want a story to have the right pacing where, you know, the battle should be interesting all the way to the end. Players want to kill the creature they're going to fight as fast as they can. And in Epic Tier, they're going to be able to do it. So you have to find a way to be able to stretch out the pace of the game so that they start off, you know, the players might start off a little slower and then builds up to the end where the end is the big crescendo rather than the crescendo happening in round one. And now you have this gimpy, you know, Orcus running around with a bucket on its head and a kick me sign on his ass, you know, while the players are having fun chasing him around. So one of the ways to do that is to make sure that your boss characters are protected, that they have some other kinds of external protection other than just their defenses and other than just, you know, typical things. And I like the, you know, three runes or four rune traps or, you know, the weird altars in the room that are giving them some kind of invulnerability to things that, you know, they were going to face. And you don't want them to be complete invulnerability. You want them to be like, you know, they're healing for 30 every round unless you get rid of the dark altar that's giving them this extra energy. So now you have these in-battle skill challenges that they have to go spend their time on in order to get to the point where they can even start beating the guy up. I'm a fan of those. You don't want to use them all the time, but you know, for your bosses, you've got to have something that's going to prevent, you know, what I consider to be the big dangers: massive damage spikes, forced movement, immobility, or status effects. They have to be able to handle that stuff, or they're going to die really fast and really hard. And then last, I always like to pitch Dave Chalker's The Out. He wrote an article for Critical Hits that kind of defined it. The idea here is that the battle that you run shouldn't just be killing the monsters. The battle should have some other trigger that can either end it early or can bring a different kind of threat to the players other than just beasts that you beat down until they're dead. It might be as simple as all you have to do is bloody them all and they will do something else. It might be that you have to destroy those, you know, four of these altars. And once the altars are destroyed, you know, so is the creature. You know, the big one I'm a fan of is when you kill the boss, you kill everything else. So that way the boss is the main thing that they're battling. But those outs can really keep your battle streamlined. You can change the out a lot and it will completely make your battle different than any other battle that you've run. So every battle really feels unique and interesting. So I'm a huge fan of that, and it works just as well. It works at all tiers, but in Epic tier, you know, it's a way to turn those two-hour battles. I mean, maybe they're every, you know, and you know, I know Dave and Dave Chalker and Phil Menard and Quinn have all said, look, if sometimes a two-hour battle is fine. Sometimes that two-hour battle is really interesting and people are really into it. So don't make it short just because you don't want it to be 2 hours. But I know when my battles go 2 hours, half my players are asleep at the table or playing Angry Birds. So I need to do something to make sure that when that battle starts to get to the point where it's not really holding their attention, that it ends one way or another.
Yeah. And what I like about the idea of the out is that it starts you forcing you to think about different ways to end the encounter. So even if you don't use that out, you can be a little bit flexible because, you know, maybe they get to the out and they're about to end the encounter and things are actually just started hitting their climax. You can get creative with that out then and say, well, you know what? Maybe they don't quit when they're bloodied because we're having too much fun with this encounter. Let's keep going. And maybe they quit when half of them are dead or whatever.
Right. Flexible outs are really important. Yeah. You know, and you need to be able to change it.
And sometimes, darn it, you're going to kill Zaztam or he's going to win. So there is no out.
Zaztam, I would not just put him in alone because you're going to be sad when Zaztam gets his ass handed to him.
Right, but you get my point.
Some weeks putting him together.
Sometimes you're at the end of that of that quest or whatever, and you don't do the out. You say, you know what, this guy's the villain. You got to beat him.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Right. As long as they're having fun.
That's right. All right. Well, I think those are some good tips all around about how to make your stories more epic. About how to keep things moving as a player and keep yourself on top of things, and some tips on how to, you know, as a DM, how to really stick it to your players. Tracy, is that everything? Did we cover it all? Are you ready to run an epic tier game?
Sure. I can do it. I'll just take some of Mike's stuff from his website and just run it. I saw the pictures. Yay.
All right, so Mike, that means that Tracy is running the two of us in an epic tier game at Gen Con. I think I heard her promise that.
Awesome, I'll play.
Sure. It'll
be the first time I played an epic tier game.
That'll be cool, I'll be there.
I'll do it.
Done. At Hooters?
I have months to prepare. Are you sure, oh, yeah. We can do it at Hooters.
Awesome. I was just going to say, anybody who's at Gen Con, we'll plan on that, Friday night, Hooters, 8 o'clock. So put that in your schedule right now.
Awesome.
During the Ennies?
Is that what, is that during the innies? We won't be up for it. That's fine.
I'm not going to win anyway.
Okay. Well, yeah. Anyways, that's episode 170.
You can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com. And don't forget to call the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for upcoming episodes.
And don't forget about the Tomes New Life contest happening now. For the remainder of March, call into the Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME and share your tips on using puzzles in the game. And then swing by the forums to share your experiences with evil PCs.
You can win some great prizes from Noble Knight, Aaliyah Tools, Obsidian Portal, Kobold Quarterly, Epic Words, Sonic Legends, Q Workshop, Gnomes Do, and more, including Sly Flourish.
And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds and it helps keep us on the air.
Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. In this episode, we've hit them with everything we have.
We've made our stories huge.
And we've organized our massive array of powers to make things epically awesome. In episode 170 of...
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.